Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, the U.S. Pivot to Asia, where we are and how Asia has responded, with Ambassador Michael H. Armacost. My name is Cynthia Miyashita. I am the chair of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs program, and I will be your host for tonight. Ambassador Michael Armacost is currently a Shorenstein Distinguished Fellow at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University. Prior to coming to Stanford, he served as president of the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., the nation's oldest think tank and a leader in research on politics, government, international affairs, economics, and public policy. Armacost began his career in academia as a professor of government at Pomona College. In 1969, he was awarded a White House fellowship and was assigned to the Secretary and Deputy Secretary of State. He later became a special assistant to the U.S. ambassador in Tokyo from 1972 to 1974. From 82 to 84, he served as U.S. ambassador to the Philippines and was a key force in helping the country undergo a nonviolent transition to democracy. In 1989, President George Bush appointed him to become ambassador to Japan, considered one of the most important and sensitive U.S. diplomatic posts abroad. Armacost is the author of three books, the most recent of which, Friends or Rivals, draws on his tenure as ambassador. He also co-edited with Daniel Okimoto, The Future of America's Alliances in Northeast Asia. He has served on numerous corporate nonprofit boards, including TRW, Aflac, Applied Materials, and Cargill. He currently chairs the board of the Asia Foundation. A native of Ohio, Armacost graduated from Carleton College and earned his master's and doctorate in public law and government from Columbia University. He has received distinguished service awards from the president, as well as from the defense and state departments. The Japanese government awarded him the Grand Cordon of the Order of the Rising Sun. Would you please welcome Michael Armacost.
Thank you, Cynthia. I had the reverse problem when I was serving in Manila. Carlos Romulo was the foreign minister, and he was very short. So he always arranged the microphone to his convenience, and the audience only saw the top of my head. I'm pleased to see an audience here this evening. I know the president's speaking as we speak, and I thought you would all be home. So I'm glad to have someone listen to what I planned to say. I'm particularly pleased to be able to speak about U.S. policy in Asia. It has been a major preoccupation of mine for 45 or more years. I've gotten to an age where I don't see very much that seems to me new under the sun. Throughout my adult life, Asia always seemed consequential, and America always played a leading role there, so when the president announced a pivot back to Asia, it seemed to me this was a return to normalcy after a decade of excessive immersion in conflicts in the Middle East and South Asia. I would like to devote my time this evening to three questions. First, what are the components of what the president called a pivot back to Asia, but which has been relabeled as a rebalancing to Asia? And what progress have we made in implementing those objectives? Secondly, how have Asians reacted to what we've done? And thirdly, what kinds of tweaks might we introduce in our policy now, given the reactions of Asians and given the changes of conditions on the ground? I think the components of the rebalancing to Asia are very clear. There are five. First, the administration was keen on taking a more active role in Asian regional institutions. And we've made some headway in that regard. We have taken ASEAN seriously as a regional institution. We have acceded to the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, which was required for us to be eligible to join the East Asian Summit, the general broader annual meeting, which the president regularly now participates in. We have tried, with what I would regard as indifferent results, to revitalize APEC, which we and the Aussies and the Japanese created about two decades ago. And we've utilized our involvement in the ASEAN Regional Forum, which is the closest thing in Asia to a security institution, to promote peaceful and multilateral resolutions of maritime disputes. Woody Allen, I think it was, observed that 90% of life is just showing up. And I would say, as far as Asian regional institutions are concerned, it's better to be on the inside looking out than on the outside looking in. So I would give the administration reasonably high marks on this first component. Second, I think the administration somewhat belatedly recognized that you didn't have much of an Asian policy if there wasn't a strong trade or economic dimension to it. And it finally got around in 2011 to ratifying a bilateral free trade agreement that had been negotiated with South Korea in 2007. And it began touting or promoting the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a larger multilateral effort to institute high-standard free trade agreements with eight negotiating partners. When I first came to know a bit about the TPP, I found it a little perplexing. It was difficult to discover what concept was driving it. It was very difficult to discover the state of play in the negotiations. Since the eight negotiating partners represented only about 5% of our total trade, moreover, it seemed to lack heft. But I must say, in the course of the last year, as the Mexicans, the Canadians, and now the Japanese have become negotiating partners, it seemed like a more serious venture. In fact, if agreements are reached, it could be a very big deal. It seems to me that the negotiations are proceeding very intensively. I think the last round finished in Brunei about 3 or 4 weeks ago. The Washington folks still anticipate a fairly early agreement. I think they refer to the end of the year as the deadline. I still wonder whether an administration can advance a complex trade agreement to Congress in a year where a midterm election is scheduled. I'm not personally so enthusiastic about the inclusion of a number of non-trade items like environmental and labor standards in what is an extremely complicated trade negotiation in any event. And it seems to me that if we want to promote trade liberalization broadly in Asia, we need to lure more of the major economies into this game. China, India, Indonesia, and South Korea are among the countries currently on the sidelines, although I doubt that Seoul will remain there for very long. So despite where the negotiation may stand at the moment, this seems to me to have become a quite serious venture, and I'm very heartened to see that they have appointed a serious person in Michael Froman to be the U.S. trade representative and our chief negotiator. Third, the administration indicated its intent to strengthen our security role in Asia by refurbishing traditional alliances, by distributing our troops to some degree into Southeast Asia and Oceania, and by exempting our military presence in the Far East from the cuts that were looming in the Pentagon budget. Now, I think it's done a good job of putting the base issues in Okinawa back on the back burner, where they belong. I believe the Operation Tomodachi in Japan, through which American forces very generously assisted the Japanese in responding to the March 11th earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster in Fukushima. It has truly altered the perception of many Japanese about the nature of the alliance and the character of our relationship with them. I think the administration's also done a good job in transforming a bilateral alliance with South Korea into what amounts to a kind of global partnership. It has also dispatched some units of Marines to a base in Darwin, Australia. It has announced its intent to home port combat ships to Singapore, or in Singapore. It has negotiated with the Philippine government to secure wider access to places, not bases, places for training and other purposes. So these, I think, are all good things. I would characterize the deployment of U.S. troops to Southeast Asia as more than symbolic, but these are very modest undertakings, at least at present. While tensions in our alliance with Japan have eased, none of the Marines that we agreed in 2006 to move from Okinawa to Guam or other places have yet moved. The Futenma base issue in Okinawa remains unresolved. The proposal for resolving it that has been embraced by both the Japanese and American government, namely to move the base from a very dense urban area in Ginawan to a more remote rural area in Hinoko, enjoys, as far as I can tell, no perceptible support in Okinawa. And meanwhile, the heightened nationalism in Northeast Asia is very much complicated. Security cooperation, or indeed the relationship between our two major Northeast Asian allies, Japan and South Korea. So I'd regard developments in the security picture to be a rather mixed bag. Fourth, the administration has attempted to engage diplomatically the pariah countries of East Asia. It is mainly focused on Myanmar, where it has normalized the relations with the government and has dismantled the very complex array of sanctions that were constructed over several decades against the military regime there. I would applaud the actions that we've taken. I think they encourage political reform in Myanmar, and I think they've also relieved the government there of what was becoming an excess dependence on China. The United States also sought to negotiate moratoria on several aspects of North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile program, an effort which culminated in what was called the Leap Day Agreement, because it was signed on February 29th. Unfortunately, our negotiators failed to secure a written commitment from Pyongyang that explicitly ruled out satellite launches as part of their promise to freeze ballistic missile tests. And when they chose to put a tiny satellite in a wobbly orbit in commemoration of the 100th birthday of Kim Il-sung, naturally, like most agreements with North Korea, this one vanished into thin air. Finally, I would say the administration has focused on trying to find the delicate balance between constructive engagement on the one hand with Beijing and on the other hand hedging against the dramatic increase in its power. It has seemed to me that in 2009, 2010, they leaned pretty heavily in the direction of engagement. In 2011, 2012, they may have overcorrected a bit in the direction of hedging. But in any event, the relationship seems to me not as buoyant as the administration sometimes contends, but not as problematic as its critics often maintain. Our bilateral trade continues to grow. We're China's largest export market. They're our biggest creditor. Military-to-military contacts, which are often the first victim when tensions between us increase, are now beginning to be fleshed out again. Our consultative arrangements with Beijing are extremely elaborate, although a bit formal and bureaucratic for my taste. At the same time, we're engaged in a more intense rivalry in cyberspace. The Chinese seem to honor the principle of national treatment for our firms and other foreign firms more in the breach rather than the observant. As the Chinese Navy grows, its capabilities impinge more directly, and I would say more uncomfortably, on U.S. Consciousness and U.S. interests in maritime Asia, and particularly on the maritime Asians themselves. And I think Beijing's tactics in its island disputes with others in the East and South China Seas have become more ostentatiously muscular and implicitly coercive. So the 8-hour shirt-sleeve summit that was organized last summer down in Southern California between President Obama and President Xi was to me a welcome sign that both leaders seem to recognize the utility of regular, wide-ranging conversation about the fundamentals of the relationship we're apparently seeking to build. So to summarize, I would say we've made some progress in preserving, even augmenting, a robust American role in Asia. I would not claim that our role in the region has been decisively transformed. How then have the Asians reacted? I would say there are three broad types of reactions. You'll remember that many of China's neighbors were rather alarmed at China's assertiveness after the financial crisis and the general global recession that ensued. And they came to Americans back in 2010, 2011, urging us to remain deeply engaged in the region as a kind of counterweight to China's rapidly growing power. By and large, I would say those countries have been reassured by the rhetorical commitment of the United States to rebalancing effort and to the concrete steps that have been taken to give this a bit of substance. Secondly, among those who generally approve of our involvement in the region, there are a number who wonder whether or not there's less there than meets the eye. And the reasons for their reservations or their skepticism or their misgivings vary. Some surmise that the interest in rebalancing to Asia was just a passing fancy, and that the Middle East is a gigantic tar pit from which the U.S. is either unlikely to escape or will escape with only the greatest of difficulty. It's difficult to deal with this contention. It's undoubtedly the case that the president is spending a disproportionate share of his time these days worrying about Syria. Prior to the chemical weapons attack, Secretary Kerry seemed to be primarily interested in reviving what had become a very moribund peace process between the Arabs and the Israelis. The disarray in Egyptian politics, the sectarian strife in Iraq, the ongoing nuclear activities in Iran have all been distractions. And as 2014 approaches, it is inevitable that Washington people will have to devote a fair amount of time, attention, and perhaps resources to what happens as the last U.S. combat forces are extricated from that country. Then there are some who dismiss U.S. actions to advance the rebalance as more symbolic than substantive. Some doubt that we can sustain our existing military presence in the region given the fiscal realities in the United States. They will acknowledge that that presence has survived the first sequester, but doubt that it can survive the next one or the one after that. Or some, whatever their attitudes toward the TPP, wonder whether an administration can close a deal there given the power of the unions in the Democratic Party and the gridlock that prevails in legislative-executive relations in our nation's capital. Some Japanese and some Filipinos have more explicit concerns. Namely, they wonder whether, when push comes to shove, the United States will provide the backing they hope for in their territorial disputes with Beijing. And finally, there are those who feel that the rebalance does not essentially address the deepest source of their concerns about the U.S., namely whether or not we are capable or willing to tackle purposefully the problems we face at home, dodgy public finances, anemic economic growth, dysfunction in Washington, that are sapping our national strength and are undermining, in their view, Washington's willingness to provide the kind of leadership in Asia to which they have become accustomed. So this is a range of views by Asians who welcome us there but are skeptical about the substance of this rebalance. Finally, there are the Chinese, who are on the other end of the political spectrum. I don't know whether Chinese officials or Chinese leaders believe that the U.S. designed the rebalance in order to contain China, to weaken its power, to deny it the fruits of its rise, but that is what they say. And they often add that we're encouraging our allies to pick fights with Beijing in order to make them more dependent on Washington and trying to design economic arrangements in the region, which frees Beijing out. But I don't regard this criticism of the Chinese, which they express with great emotion and great consistency, to be particularly convincing. Why? Well, for one thing, there's nothing in the U.S. rebalance to Asia that heralded a U.S. military buildup in that region. Rather, it was designed to avoid a big drawdown in the face of our fiscal problem. So it was a kind of a maintenance strategy at a time when China was rapidly increasing its own power. Second, I don't think that a containment strategy, if one has in mind the kind of policy George Kennan conceived for responding to the Soviet Union in the Cold War, is even conceivable against China. When we were containing the Soviet Union, we were strategic rivals. We had virtually no trade. The Russians or the Soviets were not integrated into a global economy. China very much is. I don't think you could conceive of a multilateral alliance like NATO structured to hem the Chinese in. We couldn't do it against the Russians in Asia in the Cold War. And it's really not possible, in my view, against the Chinese at a time when the Chinese have supplanted the United States as the leading trade partner of every other Asian country. Most Asian countries recognize that they are more deeply dependent on Chinese market than on the U.S. market. And they don't want to have to choose between their economic interests and their strategic concern. They still look to Washington for protection. We have no interest in forcing countries to make such a choice. And therefore, this is the idea of containment is not really part of Washington's plans, and if anything akin to it begins to take shape in Asia, it will be a response to Chinese conduct, not to admonitions or pressures from Washington. If we're attempting to weaken China, moreover, we're sure doing a lousy job of it. We are the largest buyer of Chinese goods. We invest heavily in China's growth. We facilitated its entry into the World Trade Organization. We have helped it increase its representation in the IMF. We created the G20 to supplant the G8 as the locale for macroeconomic coordination in the international economy. Japan alone represented Asia in the G8. Six Asian countries are in G20, and China is playing a very large role. We consult with the Chinese on a very wide range of subjects. We have no great stake in these island disputes other than to assure that they're not resolved by force. We are not the gatekeepers of the TPP. We don't have the prerogative of excluding countries. They exclude themselves unless they're willing to step up to the kind of trade disciplines that are being negotiated. Perhaps the Chinese don't welcome more energetic competition from the United States and Asia. But they have undertaken their own rebalance years ago when they began to pursue their interest and wield influence in areas well beyond Asia, including our own backyard. I've never seen any indication that Washington welcomed China's role in the Western Hemisphere, but I don't hear much whining out of Washington about it. It's simply accepted as a reality. And it seems to me we can't ignore Chinese criticism about the rebalance, but we don't have to pay too much attention to it either, and we ought to challenge it. The Chinese are among the big boys. They want to talk to us about a new pattern of relations with the great powers. They could start by ceasing to regularly portray themselves as a victim. Let me then turn to the adjustments that we might contemplate for our Asian policy. The first point I'd make is to remind us that the objective of people making foreign policy is not to mollify critics. It is to advance or defend your own interests. And that's what we should be about. Second, I would say we can afford to play down the military dimensions of the rebalance exercise. I'm constantly reading the papers that some senior American defense official shows up in Hanoi. And I'm wondering, what in the world are we doing? We know that fuels paranoia in Beijing. It's difficult for me to understand what concrete American interests these trips advance. For that matter, I'd be inclined to play down China's military power. It cannot be ignored. They're building a blue water navy. They have shot a satellite out of outer space. They have managed in a test to intercept a ballistic missile in mid-flight. They bought an aircraft carrier from the Ukraine, and they got a few of their own on the drawing boards. They're testing, I gather, prototypes of stealth aircraft. So these are serious people. And this warrants a lot of vigilance on our part. But I think we tend to ignore the fact that we still account for 40% of all military spending in the world. We tend to neglect the fact that we operate daily, militarily, in China's neighborhood. They have no corresponding capacity to do the same in ours and won't for many years. We have powerful allies in Asia, in Japan and South Korea and Philippines and Taiwan, Thailand are becoming very impressive developing countries. Australia is a powerful ally. We have a strong relationship with India. Who are China's strategic partners? North Korea and Pakistan, whose most noteworthy attributes are their failing qualities and their reputation for unreliability. Beijing, moreover, faces really truly daunting domestic problems. They plan to move 400 million people from the countryside into urban centers over the next decade or so. Just imagine the jobs they'll have to create, the infrastructure they'll have to build, the social tensions they'll be forced to manage. They won't be able to afford too many foreign distractions. The Chinese have been financing defense modernization on the margins of growth. Their economic growth pace is slowing down. As they pursue a global trade and a global resource diplomacy and pursue other interests well beyond Asia, they'll have to distribute their power assets among a growing range of interests. Even as we, if we're successful in focusing more attention on Asia, will be able to allocate ours among a narrowing range of interests. And finally, Chinese have to live with one inescapable geopolitical fact. There are 14 countries on their border, a number of whom are formidable military powers in their own right. The Russians have the second largest nuclear arsenal. The Japanese have the second most sophisticated economy. The Indians have the second largest population. And the Chinese know from their own bitter experience that the Vietnamese and the Koreans are no pushover to patsy. So these are among the problems that the Chinese face, and we need to bear these in mind when we talk about what we are doing in the military sphere in the region. I would personally avoid suggestions that our objective is the retention of military dominance in the area. Our historic strategic objective in Asia has been to prevent any other country or any coalition of potentially hostile countries from achieving hegemony in that region. That remains an enduring American interest, and it is, I believe, a readily achievable objective. The bottom line is this: no stable balance of power in the Asian-Pacific area is conceivable without a robust American role, and the U.S. remains determined to play such a role. But that doesn't mean there's something magic about the current levels or the composition of American forces in Asia. Those force levels and the composition of those forces were determined at an earlier time under very different conditions. And the force structure will change, inevitably. Everybody in Washington, I think, knows that the Navy and the Air Force are destined to win the big budget battles in the Pentagon. And properly so. Asia's a vast area. They provide new mobility. The administration has also determined that it won't maintain ground forces for extensive stabilization operation. That is, for nation-building enterprises, which we've tried recently in Iraq and Afghanistan. That being the case, Given the uncertainties about how China will utilize the power it's rapidly accumulating, it's probably not a good time to be adjusting downward American forces in Asia. But it still seems anomalous to me that 40 years after President Nixon announced the Guam Doctrine and 20 years after the Cold War ended, we've got 20,000 Army personnel in Korea, and we've got nearly 20,000 Marines in Okinawa. There have got to be some further adjustments down the line. This isn't the best time for them, but we ought to be thinking about them. As far as our economic policy in the region is concerned, it seems to me we need to raise our game. We need to inject some transparency into the TPP negotiation. Even Congress complains it's left in the dark trying to figure out what the state of play is. I think we need to be more realistic about the time objectives of when we expect to deliver agreement. But above all, the administration has got to begin aggressively preparing the political ground to mobilize domestic support for any agreements it's able to strike. We have no fast-track authority. Asian countries are not going to renegotiate the terms of agreements once we submit them to Congress. We have to have the ground prepared for that. And yet, as far as I'm aware, the administration has not begun to brief the Congress, not begun to brief the press, not begun to brief the public on the trade-offs that are likely to be required to achieve an equitable and beneficial set of TPP agreements. I personally wish it was devoting more time to that and less time to preparing military strikes in the Middle East, but that's a subject for another forum that's taking place next door, I believe. With respect to our policies toward the Asian pariah countries, as I've said, I applaud what it's doing in Myanmar. I think it's laudable. As for North Korea, Pyongyang directed extremely bellicose threats against South Korea, against Japan, and against the United States last spring. By late summer, they had turned to what some in the press have termed a charm offensive, if the terms North Korean charm and charm are not a totally oxymoronic notion. In any event, it seems to me Pyongyang's tactics can change, but the game's the same. And the name of the game is show me the money. And the appropriate response to that game is the old maxim, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I'm personally quite happy to see the administration returning to what it termed a policy of strategic patience, which I guess amounts to waiting around in hopes that something will turn up. I would use some of that time to explore intensively with the Chinese the possibility of fashioning a joint strategy to encourage the denuclearization of North Korea. We've often acted in the past as though we have a coincident interest with China in a non-nuclear Korean peninsula, and of course we do, but we don't accord the same priority to that objective. We're obsessed with the nuclear issue. It dominates every conversation we have with the North Korean. The Chinese are principally focused on stability on their border. And this often boils down basically to keeping the food and fuel deliveries going, no matter what kind of provocations are mounted by the Kim dynasty next door. There have been some indications during the last few months the Chinese are having a new look at the policy. They certainly have permitted their newspapers to run critical op-eds by scholars and even some minor official. And it's devoutly to be hoped that they would adjust their policy as a recognition that North Korean nukes represent a national security problem for them. After all, it increases the pressures both in South Korea and Japan to consider at least a nuclear option of their own. And even if they don't consider that option, both are more likely to build ballistic missile defenses, which the Chinese object to also. So the Chinese have a stake in what's going on next door, and we would hope they might adopt a more tough-minded approach. I doubt personally that they will, but it seems to me it's really something that is worth looking into. it would require surely a high-level conversation that would have to be very comprehensive and very subtle. Whether the administration can manage such a delicate diplomatic endeavor with the requisite discretion and sense for nuance, I don't know, but I think it's probably worth a try. More generally, I think the time is ripe for a significant effort to put our relations with Beijing on a more solid footing. When I was working for George Shultz back in the 1980s, we faced a similar need to put our relations with Beijing back on track. And the Shultz modus operandi was conceptually very simple, and the execution was, I thought, very impressive. He went to China's leaders, and he outlined in a very blunt but very respectful way America's concern about Chinese policy. He invited them with comparable frankness to lay their own concerns about the United States on the table. He proposed, and Beijing agreed, that we set up a comprehensive agenda, agree to regular high-level meetings where we'd systematically work through that agenda. As we did so, naturally, we discovered in areas where we had converging interests, we were able to translate those into either new or deepened cooperation. We found issues on which our interests diverged, but on which we were able to agree to disagree. We discovered that some of those disagreements were tempered over time by the dialogue itself. We discovered ways of thinking about the problem differently, and that turned up ways of approaching them in a different fashion. Mutual interest, or mutual trust, was not the proximate aim of that exercise, but we discovered in working with the Chinese that a fair amount of it actually developed. Today, both Washington and Beijing complain a lot about strategic distrust, and God knows there's plenty of it to go around. Hopefully, this Obama-Xi meeting, these small meetings of the top leaders, if revisited thoughtfully, if convened regularly with appropriate preparations, can help dissipate that distrust as we work through a fresh agenda. I suppose that is what the annual Strategic and Economic Dialogue, which is co-chaired by the Secretary of State and Treasury and officials of comparable weight in China, was created to do. But it nonetheless seems to me it needs the impetus that can only be supplied from the very top. A word is in order about our domestic problems. I believe unless we renew our strength at home, our policies in Asia will not inspire the respect we desire nor the support we need. We're not a nation in decline, as some Chinese believe. But our relative power in that region, as in other regions, has diminished. Still, we continue to kick our problems down the road. Our debts continue to soar. We tolerate lousy schools. Much of our national infrastructure is in decay. We put up with dysfunction in Washington. We express disdain for Washington, but we don't hold it accountable by systematically voting incumbents out. We can do a lot better. And we don't need to despair about our prospects because America is a very resilient country. We still have the world's largest market and the most transparent financial system. The natural gas and tight oil boom is enabling us to resume our role of the 1940s as a net energy exporter. As the costs of fuel go down, U.S. manufacturing improves, and we're beginning to see some onshoring of jobs in that sector. We're one of the few rich countries whose population is still expanding. Our universities are still the gold standard. We're without peer as a source of innovation and entrepreneurship. I think it was high time that the administration acknowledged the significance of Asia, and I trust it'll continue to put concrete steps in place that reflect the importance of that region. And it is very important, I think, for Americans to acknowledge that there are a lot of positive things taking place in Asia. We tend to dwell on the problems like the maritime disputes and the North Korean nukes, but there are plenty of opportunities as well. The prospect of conflict among the major powers in Asia is very remote. interdependence, economic interdependence, is huge. It is growing. Regional institutions are taking shape, and they are susceptible to our influence. The Taiwan Strait, for decades a lightning rod for contention and conflict, is more tranquil now than it's been in 65 years. Southeast Asia is vibrant with growth. I would close on this hopeful note. I saw a recent Australian white paper in which the authors, representing the government, noted that in the 21st century, every Asian country faces three preeminent challenges: food security, water security, energy security. It just so happens that the United States possesses ample supplies of food, water, and energy. And we have the superior technologies others covet to extract, to sustain, and to distribute those resources. In short, we have an abundance, what Asians perhaps need the most. And that should help give us confidence about our ability to retain a strong position in Asia, and if we're thoughtful and resourceful, seal productive partnerships that will assure a strong position for us there for decades to come. I thank you for attention. I'm glad to take a swing at your questions. In the back.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you for your service. I was the Economist correspondent in Tokyo in the 70s and was a close friend of Ambassador Mike Mansfield.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't say much about Japan. Probably one of the biggest questions facing the global economy today is whether the recovery in Japan is sustainable. And can they deal with the 240% debt to GDP that frightens so many people?
Yeah. Well, that was the answer to the trivia question. Who in the hell was that guy we had in Tokyo between Mansfield and Mondale? I think that Mr. Abe is on the right track. He's done things on the currency and on public work spending that have given them a little boost. Certainly the market has responded. And the question is whether there is follow-through on the structural issues which he's committed to address. And I think he will. They have witnessed a couple of decades of sluggishness. It's desperately important to them that they resume their growth. There's a palpable sense, I think, in Japan that they face national security challenges that are real for the first time in a long time, and they know that their capacity to respond to those depends upon the state of their economy. I should have said that the preservation of our alliances with Japan and South Korea are particularly important at a time when we're seeking the denuclearization of North Korea. And it seems to me we need to be particularly attentive to the credibility of extended deterrence, that is, our nuclear umbrella, because nonproliferation remains a core objective of the United States. And some of our proudest accomplishments, of course, have been the fact that Japan, Germany, South Korea, Taiwan, have not gone down that nuclear route. But our allies need to do more for their own security as well. And during the last decade, Beijing increased its military spending by 270%. In 10 of the last 11 years, Tokyo's defense budget declined. It increased this year, but only by 0.8%. That's not a sustainable proposition. Tokyo knows that. I believe Mr. Abe is serious not only about getting the economy back into a phase of vibrant growth, but of adjusting the national security policy of the country. We don't need to rag him on that. I think we do need to redefine the division of labor between Japan and the United States strategically in the region. And it's interesting to me that the Philippines, a country occupied by Japan during the war, has called publicly for Japan to play a larger regional security role. Things are changing. And I think Mr. Abe is on to that. I take him seriously on both the security and economic issues. I think it would help if he would discipline his nationalist rhetoric a bit so that he doesn't divert attention to Japan's past rather than focusing on future challenges. In any event, I should have addressed the economic issue. I'm reasonably hopeful that he's on the right track. It is discouraging, however, to see TEPCO continue to mishandle the nuclear issue up in Fukushima. They don't seem to be onto that problem, but it is heartening over the last week or so to see that Japan, which was quite resistant initially to any foreign help on managing that disaster, has welcomed foreign experts, including our own, to assist it in diagnosing and treating the continuing mishaps and miscues that have been taking place most recently in Fukushima. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's my best effort.
Ambassador Armacost, I was curious what you'd mentioned how U.S. National interest in Asia has always been about preventing a country from becoming dominating that area, exercising hegemony in that area. But I wonder how realistic it is, given that you've got a China that has a lot of, you know, historical baggage and is based and has, seems to have a national interest of becoming very rich and very strong. And as it grows and it becomes rich and strong, I would suspect that a lot of the American Asian allies would kind of hedge and, you know, want to get a lot closer with China, and so then that would impact our alliance system. And one way or the other, you know, maybe it's just perceptions, but it just seems to me that, that China is bound to become at least a rival or at least a country that is rich and strong, and you've got a domestic political system where the politicians are very used to power politics as well. I mean, it's hard to see how this is all going to be very peaceful, and then you've got this flashpoint of Taiwan as well. But I'd be curious to see, you know.
I think it's going to be very competitive. That I have no doubt. And it may well be that a contest for supremacy in the region is inevitable. But it's certainly worth the effort to try and avoid it. It's worth the effort to see whether or not a different pattern of great power relations can develop. After all, people talk about this as being an Asian century. I don't think that's inevitable. It's inevitable much of the competition will take place, unfold in Asia, because China, as you say, is a great country. I think its achievements deserve respect. But I also think it's possible to work with China because for the next decade or so, as I've said, they got really overwhelming problems at home. They need a respite. We need a respite. We can't ignore each other. We'll keep our military strong. It's not hard when you get budgets the size of ours. But as I said, as they become global, they've got to distribute their assets across a wider range of interests. And depending on whether or not we're serious about focusing on ours more sharply on Asia, we can distribute ours a little more narrowly. That makes it competitive, but I have no doubt China's a big force. And countries won't want to defy China, but they will want to have an anchor to windward with countries like the United States. And, as I said, we've got powerful allies. When you look at India, Japan, the maritime states in Southeast Asia, Russia will play a role. Russia currently is a kind of friendly ally of the Chinese, but there are primordial fears in Russia about China as its strength grows. If they encroach directly on the interests of neighbors, the natural instinct of neighbors is to consider coalescence with others. That's the way the balance of power historically works. And that's what we saw in embryonic form in 2010. It's why the U.S. has been encouraged by Asians to keep a deep hand in that region. And that's, I think, what the administration intends to do, and I would presume its successor, whoever that may be, will do the same because of the significance of the area, because of its economic dynamism, because it's where the interests of the great powers intersect most directly. It's where we run our largest, most durable trade deficits. It's where the big new powers are emerging. It's where we face the most urgent non-proliferation problem in North Korea. So we've got plenty of interests that will keep us anchored there. The Chinese will be a huge factor. Maybe intense rivalry is unavoidable. But as I say, it's worth trying to temper that rivalry with a lot of cooperative activities in the economic realm, and we've managed to build a huge, robust relationship with them already.
Yes, Mr. Ambassador. Two questions on China, on two issues you touched on. One is North Korea, and the other is the little fights over the little islands between them. And China always strikes me as rather pragmatic, and they're looking for growth. And I'm really puzzled by the little fights on these islands, which seem like more macho issues than really substance issues. And also relative to North Korea, it's a drag on them. It seems like they would be happy, and I understand they want to have a buffer zone, but they would be happy trying to resolve that issue somehow so they had a more stable country there. So I guess those two questions, it just doesn't seem that it makes sense for China to be doing those two things when they have better chances to build their economy with more trade and better relations.
Well, with regard to the island dispute with Japan, there are actually three disputes, maritime disputes. One is over the maritime boundary between them. Japan relies on the median line theory, where the Chinese argue the continental shelf theory. So they wind up with different borders between them in the sea between. Second is their respective claims to the Senkaku, their Diaoyu Island, which the Japanese argue that they exercised control at a time when the Chinese had no practical claim to the island, and before the Sino-Japanese War, and therefore they're properly exempt from the wartime declarations in World War II, where Japan was impelled to give up any land acquired through its imperialism. The Chinese maintain it was historically a Chinese territory. And then they have a dispute over whether there's a dispute. The Japanese argue there's no dispute. The Chinese argue there is. The evidence is actually a little unclear. The diplomatic exchanges, which took place at the time Japan normalized with China in 1972, was preceded by a visit by a Kometo leader. And he raised this issue, the Senkakus, in his third meeting, I think, with China's leaders, and he found that Zhou Enlai wasn't particularly interested. It wasn't an issue he wanted to put high on the agenda. And the reason, I think, in retrospect, quite self-evident. They were worried about the Russians, and they needed Japan's help. And they had no navy with which to contest Japanese claims, and the Japanese were busy building a navy. In 1978, when Deng Xiaoping went to Tokyo, in both the meetings with Japanese officials and the press conference that followed, he made a statement that this issue was something to be left for future generations who would be wiser in managing it. In short, they considered that the issue was put on the shelf. And whether or not the Japanese tacitly understood and agreed to that is what is in dispute. But the Japanese didn't intercede either in the private meeting or in the press conference to contest Deng Xiaoping's version. I don't want to give you a long-winded history, but I think there are two incidents that are telling. Back in 2010, you recall, a Chinese fishing vessel rammed a Japanese Coast Guard ship twice and damaged it. Some months before, citizens of Hong Kong, I believe, had, with Chinese encouragement, landed on the Senkaku Island. The Japanese had deported them immediately. When the fishing captain was arrested, the rest of the crew was released, and the ship wasn't detained. The captain was taken back to Okinawa. And the intent was to subject him to a legal proceeding because he damaged Japanese property. For a day and a half, as I am told the story, the Japanese government contemplated whether to handle that through the prosecutor general's office as a judicial matter or whether to handle it through the immigration office and deport him. And within those 36 hours, they decided to deport him. Or rather, they deported the Chinese that landed. when the fishing captain was taken back to Japan, the Chinese understood this as subjecting their citizen to a domestic Japanese legal process. And they saw this as an expression of carrying administrative control of the Senkakus beyond what they were prepared to accept. And you'll remember they reacted very strongly. There were huge demonstration, lots of property damage before the captain was released. They picked up four Japanese businessmen to treat as trading bait. They stopped all exchanges. They apparently informally stopped the embargo of rare earth metals and so forth. And in September later, when Japan, encouraged by the danger they saw in Governor Ishihara's buying up the islands, chose to nationalize them by purchasing three of the islands that were privately owned, the Chinese assumed that this was likewise a unilateral change in the status quo of an issue they regarded as being shelved under tacit agreement. And they therefore embarked on what can only be regarded as creating a parallel administrative control arrangement. And that's the situation we face now, where increasingly oceanographic survey vessels, fisheries vessels, and military vessels are in close proximity to one another, and the Japanese and Chinese, unfortunately, don't seem to have contact between their military officials that would be able wisely to manage an incident if it were to occur. So there's a certain amount of danger that is building there. And I think, hopefully, they can at least agree on some ways of containing the damage and managing tension. But there's a very fundamental difference of view, and the Chinese, as their strength grows, as their naval power expands, they, I think, are destined to be more contentious on these kind of issues. And I said they're becoming more ostentatiously muscular, and they're implicitly coercive in the way they treat both Japan and particularly the Philippines.
The ambassador, yeah. Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Yeah, sure.
How much of this has to do with oil drilling rights? They're not concerned about those little islands. They're concerned about the rights to drill up those islands. And my God, if I'm Japanese or Chinese right now, I look at the Straits of Hormuz, I look at the Suez Canal, there's no way I want a tanker going through those places forever, ad infinitum. I just as soon have my own oil, my own fuel from my own waterways. And I thought the Japanese and the Chinese, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought they had this all settled, that they made an agreement that the Japanese were going to provide technology, and the Chinese would provide manpower, and they would coordinate efforts, you know, to get the oil off the shelf.
Well, that would seem to be the logical solution to this, would be shelve the issue and jointly develop the resources. The Chinese, in the post-war period, first asserted a territorial claim after a UN survey indicated that there were natural resources in the surrounding seas of the Senkakus or Diaoyu Islands in 1970. Nobody's ever begun to jointly develop them. And in fact, in some ways, the Japanese treated this as a very delicate issue, because in that period, since they normalized relations with China, they have tried to avoid having their own citizens land on the island. They have avoided building permanent structures on the island. They have avoided military maneuvers in that proximity. And they have avoided unilateral exploitation of resources that may be there. There was an agreement in 2008 to jointly develop resources in another area near the midline, but that ran afoul of differences between them, and the development has never commenced. So it's true that both countries have immense resource requirements. It is not true that there's ever been any serious joint development of resources. It may underline the seriousness with which they regard the issue, to be sure. But they need to find a way, it seems to me, to avoid drifting toward a conflict over islands, the resources around which are still indeterminate. That was a very primitive survey that was done more than 40 years ago. There probably are resources there, but there are resources lots of places.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, the U.S. Pivot to Asia, with Ambassador Michael Armacost. And we are taking questions from our audience.
My name is Lee. First of all, I would like to comment that you make a very insightful and comprehensive analysis about Asia, in my opinion. But one thing in particular I would like to talk to you about, you make an argument about containment. The reason I want to talk, well, first of all, I think you're on target in terms of your ideas about containment. As far as my background, I spent my life in the aerospace defense industry. We build weapons against Russia, right? So I'm pretty familiar with all these kind of things. But I think your analysis is not so much military, but more logical and requires some thought by the public about your ideas. What I'm saying is you're on target in terms of your ideas about China should not think that we try to contain them. Your reasons are pretty reasonable, I think. So I agree with you 100% in that area.
Thank you. I believe it's worthwhile seeing what kind of relationship we can develop with China, and I also think it's healthy for us to develop and maintain good relations with everybody else to the kind of fallback position, because we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Hi, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for coming tonight. I haven't heard you speak much about Chinese nationalism, and my question was, is this rise in more assertive foreign policy a result of the personal preferences of the top leaders or their response to increasing nationalism, which, if ignored, could threaten the legitimacy of the regime?
I don't honestly know. I think
there was a book.
Some degree, I think nationalism is an expression of the pride of Chinese in their accomplishment. They have a right to be proud of what they've done. They've raised 500 million people out of poverty, among other things. So they've done remarkable things, and this is an expression of their satisfaction with what they've done, for one thing. It is also, I think, an expression of the kind of information technology that's available to huge numbers of Chinese citizens now. I was involved in a dialogue with Chinese defense officials a couple of years ago, and someone asked these officials, include military personnel, why don't you clarify your position on the 9-dash map, 9-dash line on the map, where they seem to be claiming virtually the entire South China Sea? And there was a long pause, and finally a lieutenant general in the PLA said, we cannot clarify our position because it's a matter of public dispute. And we later engaged that person at dinner and said, well, you know, you've had territorial discussions with a lot of countries, and you've resolved a lot of territorial issues by making concessions, and sometimes big concessions, not least to the Russians. And they said, yeah, but that was done through quiet diplomacy. Now that is impossible. There are tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of Chinese now that are on the net. And they at least claim to fear greatly appearing to retreat from previously publicly declared positions on these issues, lest they stir up the hornet's nest with their own public. It's a very convenient bargaining position for the Chinese. I suspect there's some truth to it. The Chinese military has also grown. When you have a double-digit increase in your defense spending every year for two decades, the military becomes pretty strong. And one wonders, I wonder, what the degree of civilian control is. When Deng Xiaoping was in power, he'd been on the long march. These guys' authority was not in question. Jiang Zemin built great authority. But whether the next generation, Hu Jintao and the current folks, have that kind of control of the military, I don't know, but it's probably an interest group that has a pretty strong stake in the patriotism of China. And because the legitimacy of a Marxist regime no longer can rely on any belief in Marxism or the ideology of the party, then nationalism becomes the trump card. And therefore, one doesn't know if their domestic policies begin to fail. There will be a natural temptation of China's leaders to resort to nationalism to solidify national unity. So I don't know exactly what's driving, but there are a lot of potential motives. It certainly complicates their relation with Japan. I never felt Japan has really honestly come to terms with its history. But the Chinese are not likely to be regarded as appropriate mentors on historiographical issues because since the mid-90s, the government in China has actively encouraged anti-Japanese feeling through their own textbook. So they're playing the same game. and others are too. So I think one can appropriately worry over the long term about the temptations or incentives in a lot of these countries to rely on nationalist appeals. When everybody's doing it, there's trouble brewing. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not taking the questions.
This will have to be our last question.
Hi. As a Chinese American, and we were the first business family, AT&T, in 87, so my husband set up the international communications and laid the fiber optic cable from Fuzhou to Santa Barbara, and now we have cell phones. But the history is a long, long history, and I think that I can appreciate the security military issues. And Kurt Campbell, who left the East Asia State Department, said that there needs to be more sustained contact, not just the strategic, economic, and security, which is, you know, a lot of activity for a few days, and then people don't see each other again. So as a mother and grandmother, I would like to speak to the common issue, which is global now, of high youth unemployment, and that if we can put a little less into the military budgets, because the U.S. has got the Navy base in Jeju, drones on Cocos Islands, Vandenberg still launches multiple nuclear warheads at Marshall Islands, that we get our young people, the students, up to that 100,000 of an educational exchange and fund everybody else who would like to travel and use their passports with a little less fear of the terrorism, which I think is getting to be a common concern worldwide, too, because of the gap, the global gap in the economy and the probably the repeat of another crisis coming.
Well, youth unemployment is a big problem, but you're talking to the wrong guy. I have no proposed solutions to it. I suspect it's more urgent in the Middle East than it is in China. Or Japan. Actually, Japan is quite striking because even though they've gone through a period of stagnation economically, the unemployment rate's never really gone above 5.5%.
Well, Ambassador Amarkos, many thanks for your insightful and informative remarks today at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. And thank you all for joining us. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 110 years, is now adjourned.